From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
When I was called a racist, I just lost it.
Maine Governor Paul LePage apologizes for his recent rants and says it's possible he might not finish serving his current term.
I just apologize to the Maine people, to Gatine's family, and most of all to my family. And we will take action.
Also today, a status check on efforts to prepare more students of color for Boston's exam schools. Plus, Harvard historian Leah Wright Rigueur.
Donald Trump has put Black Republicans in an incredibly difficult position by continuing behavior on the campaign trail that suggests that there is space within the so-called Party of Lincoln for people who may have racist views.
She's author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican. We'll talk with her about Donald Trump and African-American voters. That's next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Controversial Maine Governor Paul LePage told a banger radio station today that he's not sure he'll finish out his current term. But before we talk about what that might mean, let's talk about how we got here, because it's been a rather amazing 5 days for Governor LePage. Things got started last Thursday when he left an expletive-laden voicemail for Maine State Representative Drew Gatine after hearing that Gatine had called the governor a racist.
I want to talk to you. I want you to prove that I'm a racist. I've spent my life helping Black people, and you little son of a socialist, I need you to I want you to record this and make it public, because I'm after you. Thank you.
Well, at least he said thank you. The very next day, LePage held a press conference where he denied accusations that Maine police officers are racially profiling people. But then he added another incendiary comment. Now, it's a bit hard to hear, but lean in close, because this tape is well worth the listen.
Bad guy's a bad guy. I don't care what color it is. When you go to war, if you know the enemy dresses in red and you dress in blue, you shoot at red, don't you? You try to identify the enemy. And the enemy right now, the overwhelming majority of people coming in are people of color or people of Hispanic origin.
LePage was referring to alleged drug traffickers bringing opioids into Maine, but pressure was already building on the governor. Assistant House Majority Leader Democrat Sarah Gideon said in a statement, quote, "It's clear from the governor's threats that he is not mentally or emotionally fit to hold this office. I am calling on the governor to resign." But yesterday, LePage doubled down. He was in Boston for the Conference of New England Governors and Eastern Canadian Premiers.
The heroin fentanyl arrests are not white people. They're Hispanic and they're Black, and they're from Lowell and Lawrence, Massachusetts, Waterbury, Connecticut, the Bronx and Brooklyn. So I didn't make up the rules. That's how it turns out.
Well, last night, LePage met with Maine Republican leaders, and today, Maine Republicans in the State House and Senate are meeting to discuss just what to do about their governor. Which brings us to LePage's interview this morning on WVOM.
And it's really one thing to have one party behind you. It's another thing not to have any party behind you. So we have to move Maine forward, whether it's me or somebody else.
He also said, if I've lost my ability to help Maine people, maybe it's time to move on. We'll link to that entire interview at radioboston.org. Well, joining us now with more on all that's been happening in Maine, and he's joining us from Maine Public Broadcasting, is Ed Murphy, reporter for the Portland Press-Herald. Ed, welcome to Radio Boston.
Nice to speak with you.
It's good to have you. So we requested an interview with Governor LePage, but we were informed that he's traveling today and unavailable. But he did tweet just a couple hours ago, quote, "Regarding rumors of resignation, to paraphrase Mark Twain, the reports of my political demise are greatly exaggerated." So what is in the immediate future for Paul LePage?
As with many things with the governor, who knows? He did put that out there this morning, which kind of suggested that he was at least weighing resignation. And then he headed up to Baileyville, which is in pretty far northern Maine, for a paper plant opening, and tweeted when he got up there that those rumors, which emanate from him, are exaggerated. And so he seems to not be leaning in that direction right now.
Interesting, because this morning he said that, quote, "I think some things I've been asked to do are beyond my ability. I'm not going to say that I'm not going to finish it," regarding his term. "I'm not saying that I am going to finish it." Now, what was he referring to about those, quote, things he'd been asked to do?
It's not clear. He didn't specify them. Apparently, he met last night with the Speaker of the Maine House and the President of the Maine Senate, and he seemed to indicate this morning that what the Speaker of the Maine House was suggesting that he needed to do was possible, but the things that the Speaker, the President of the Maine Senate, was suggesting were not going to be possible. There were some things that he couldn't do, he said. Interestingly enough, the person who would replace him if he were to resign is Mike Thibodeau, who is the President of the Maine State Senate. So there might be some interesting machinations going on there, given that that's a possibility.
All right. To be a fly on the wall. Well, I mean, before the governor was asked about, you know, his future in Maine, he did start off that interview on WVOM with an act of contrition, you know, basically apologizing for especially that expletive laden voicemail. So let's listen to what he said.
"When I was called a racist, I just lost it. And it's no excuse. It's unacceptable. It is totally my fault. And I just apologize to the Maine people, to Gatine's family, and most of all to my family. And we will take action."
Ed, do you have any sense that that apology could mollify LePage's critics?
I doubt it. There's a long history, 6 years now of controversial statements and questionable statements, and the Democrats in Maine have now called for his resignation, and they seem to be sticking their feet in the sand on that one. There's some suggestion from some Republicans that they might censure the governor, even though there's no actual mechanism to do that in Maine. But the Democrats have already said that that's not acceptable to them. So it doesn't seem it seems like the two sides are kind of digging in here, and doesn't seem to be a real clear compromise that could get everyone to move beyond this.
Well, so that's the heated politics of the moment. But Ed, one of the reasons why we're really grateful that you could join us today is that, you know, for the past 5 days, if not longer, we've been wondering, you know, where is it that Paul LePage has been getting the information that he's basing his claims on, right? Like, all of this was triggered by him saying that he believes the vast majority, if not all, of drug trafficking and drug sales in Maine are being done by people of color, by African-Americans and Latinos. You guys at the Portland Press Herald have taken a look closely at drug trafficking in Maine. What did you find?
We found pretty much the opposite of what the governor found. The governor claimed he has a – he showed it on Friday. He has a three-ring binder of news stories about drug arrests and trafficking arrests in Maine, which is interesting because the governor also says he doesn't read newspapers. And so somebody on his staff put together this binder from him, and he claims that that's where he found that 90% plus of the drug trafficking in Maine was being done by African Americans and by Hispanics. We looked at some figures from the FBI, which compiles annual crime figures. And in Maine in 2014, which is the most recent year they have available, 85% of the people arrested for dealing drugs in Maine, making and or dealing drugs in Maine, were white. 14% were black, and then there were some Asian Pacific and Indian, I think, is how they put it.
So,
people, just a handful.
So making and or dealing drugs in Maine. Now, does that necessarily contradict what the governor has been asserting? Because I think lately he's been trying to clarify, saying, nope, I'm talking about drug traffickers bringing opioids into Maine.
Right. And he, he did kind of change that that definition of what he was trying to convey with those figures and with his binder, has been basically saying the last few days that when it comes to meth labs, those are mostly run by Mainers and run by white Mainers. But the figures that we've seen also suggest that a strong majority of people bringing in opiates, drug trafficking, at least those arrested, are still a strong majority white and a minority blacks.
Hmm. Well, Ed, hang on here with us for just a minute because I want to pull in another voice into this conversation. She's Allison Bea, Executive Director of the ACLU of Maine. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much.
Now, Ed Murphy there just referred to this binder that that Governor Paula Page says he has, where he's collecting news articles about drug arrests. The ACLU of Maine has tried to get to FOIA that binder. Have you guys been successful?
Well, we submitted a FOIA to the governor's office last week. He has until Thursday to respond to that FOIA. We are anxiously awaiting his response. He does. We asked for a very simple request, which was that we could inspect the binder, and we are hopeful that he will grant that request at the 5-day mark on Thursday.
And what specifically are you looking for?
Well, as Ed was talking about, this is not the first of the governor's statements that sort of insert race into the conversation, but this was the first time that the governor spoke of actually compiling documents. And so we at the ACLU, of course, are very interested to see what the governor is compiling and wanted to see what, in fact, he was talking about.
Hmm. Well, you know, as Ed also mentioned, it seems as if this binder, according to members of Paula Page's staff, is made up of newspaper articles. And let's just take that at face value for a moment, and suppose that's true. Could that partially explain where this perception of who the drug traffickers are is coming from? Because, you know, let's be honest, the media doesn't necessarily report on all drug arrests, but maybe the more sensational ones. And oftentimes we find lots of attention being put on members of minorities who are arrested.
Well, I think that the governor has at his disposal all of the data and documentation, the same as all the reporters do. And, you know, the governor has an obligation under the Constitution to make sure that his law enforcement are not targeting or profiling certain people. That goes against our very core American values. And so if the governor were confused, I think it's incumbent upon our elected officials to have accurate information and not insert race into a conversation where it has no place.
Yeah, so Ed, let me just turn back to you on that, because that's something else that I've been wondering. I mean, the opioid epidemic all across New England is awful. It is, mm-hmm. you know, a priority for every governor in our region. Nobody disputes that. Nobody disputes that people are being killed. They're dying. So, I mean, Governor LePage does not have to work hard to get people's attention when he wants to talk about the effect it's having on Mainers. So that's why we've been wondering, what is it that, I mean, as far as you can tell us, compelled him to bring race into this conversation, this already urgent conversation that everybody cares about?
The as far as you can tell us is the key part there. I don't think anybody really knows. The governor really hasn't offered a real clear explanation for why he thinks it's so important to, you know, quantify the races of those who were arrested for drug trafficking in Maine. And yet, whenever this subject is come up, it goes back to actually January, another town hall where he said some similar racially charged statements. He's injected race into it, and he's brought race into it, and no one's really quite sure to what end. It seems to a lot of people that the focus should be on stopping the trafficking and getting people who are addicted to these drugs into treatment, and what race the people using, what race the people dealing are, it doesn't seem to a lot of people to have much consequence. Yet the governor, when this has come up now, seems intent on bringing that into it. And it's never really – there's never really been a good explanation that I've heard anyway as to why it's important that he bring up the race of the drug dealers.
Hmm. And Allison, one more question for you. A little bit earlier, we were playing some tape where Paul LePage, again, brought up race, but it was in response to a question about accusations that Maine police may be racially profiling people. Does the ACLU of Maine have any perspective on those accusations or what might be behind that?
Well, the ACLU of Maine and the ACLU across the country has been committed to ending any sort of racial profiling. But we've also been working hand-in-hand with law enforcement in Maine and across the country as well. And they are often our greatest allies in seeking to combat any sort of unconstitutional behavior. Right now in Maine, I mean, I think that we know there are disparities between races in all aspects of our criminal justice system. There are disparities in Maine as well. Certainly any sort of, 90% arrest rate would be shocking and really suggest that we have significant problems. We don't have any evidence that that is in fact happening, but we are concerned and we are committed to working with law enforcement to make sure that racial disparities do not happen in any part of the criminal justice system.
Well, Allison Bea, with the executive director of the ACLU of Maine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Ed, before I let you go, I have to ask you about one other thing that the governor's office sent to us in a statement. The governor, Paul LePage's office, said that the Portland Press Herald has and will continue to report about Governor LePage with erroneous information as the publication's editors support biased journalism against our governor. And I just wanted to give you a chance to respond to that if you wanted to.
Well, I saw the statement as well, and Adrienne Bennett, the governor's spokeswoman, did not explain what the erroneous information she's alleging that we've been passing on consists of. I haven't heard anybody complaining. Most of the information that's around this story has been in either taped remarks or taped interviews, and I don't know of anybody that's I haven't heard of anything specific as far as any kind of erroneous information that we're reporting on.
Well, we look forward to having you back, Ed, as we see what transpires with Maine Governor Paul LePage. Ed Murphy, reporter with the Portland Press Herald, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Boston Globe reporter Stephanie Ebert joins us now. She's been reporting on the Boston Public Schools Exam School Initiative. That's a free program that prepares students for the exam that could get them into Boston Latin School or one of the city's other exam schools. And Stephanie's here now with a status check on how those efforts are going. Stephanie, welcome back to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back. Now, usually we don't really do this with reporters, but I wanted to actually play a little bit of tape from when we had you on the show earlier this month.
Okay.
Because it sort of sets the backdrop for why we wanted to have you back, because we talked about the initial efforts of the exam school initiative, and here's what you told us.
When I took a look at it for the past school year, what I found was that the attendance in the exam school initiative, which had originally been targeted to Black and Hispanic students, had become very white. So by last year, there were most of the students who were attending, it was 44% white at the exam school initiative.
So can I just stop you there?
Sure.
Because I just want to be sure that I'm hearing this correctly. So the exam school initiative, just to recap, which had been started as a response to declining enrollment or even exam of students of color taking the exam.
Right.
Has become very, that initiative itself has become 44% white?
Exactly.
Do you remember how my jaw had hit the table, Stephanie, when you told us that? So gathering up my jaw now, have efforts been going recently?
It seems to be a bit of a turnaround. The day that I spoke with you, they were giving some initial reports and have finalized the numbers. And it seems that what they've been able to do this summer with the Exam School Initiative is balance out the groups of kids who are coming so that it is, again, more targeted to those for whom it was intended. It appears this summer the kids who participated in the two-week program that just ended, they had 20% black and 26% Hispanic, and 28% white children and 20% Asian. So it seems to be inching more in line with the population of the district and the city as a whole mm-hmm. in the school age populations, which are overwhelmingly black and Latino.
So what happened to encourage that turnaround?
It's really interesting. They made a big push right after my first story ran in April. The district went out very ambitiously and admittedly not with a very complete plan, but trying very hard to get the word out to schools that were not sending a lot of kids. So they didn't mandate that they be black and Hispanic, but they did target the schools that were not sending a lot of students, and those happened to be in minority neighborhoods in many cases. And they asked for additional kids who may not have met the original criteria. So it was interesting. In this case, there wasn't a lowering of any standards. There was kind of a new standard that was added as an additional group. They added a potential 300 new seats for these kids, and they went to principals and teachers and said, give us some kids who you think have potential, no matter how they're scoring. Maybe they're not good test takers, but you see something in them that you think they might do well in an exam school if given the right training.
Right. So this was really interesting because in your story in the Globe today, you talked with Colin Rose, mm-hmm. and he used to teach at the he taught math at the Higginson Lewis K-8 school, and he said that he didn't even know that the test prep was offered when he was teaching there.
Right.
I mean, is that something that's also shifted? Are they doing more outreach to teachers themselves?
Absolutely. They're making them aware. They really pushed on the principals and the teachers to make this known this season. And I think that the awareness is up. It was shocking to me, poor Colin Rose, he was in that situation, and obviously very heartfelt that, and it was exciting to him to be able to see some kids from his school participating in this for the first time in years.
Yeah.
So I think they really got the message out and intend to do so even more so in the coming years. What they're hoping to do is to keep this going at an expanded level. Ultimately, they didn't get the full 300 kids they were hoping to get. They only got 225, but the addition of those extra kids did change the balance of the demographics a bit and made it more representative. So they're hoping to expand it again next year, and possibly even if there's additional budget, keep it going and involve more mm-hmm. children as it moves into the fall. There are additional Saturday classes in the fall.
You know, it seems as if in your reporting that Boston Public Schools are recognizing or have recognized that there are, you know, even some structural barriers that sometimes keep kids from finding out or participating in the exam prep. I mean, because you were
right.
You reported about accommodations being made for students in the exam school initiative, like free transportation
mm-hmm.
and providing meals.
Right.
How did that help?
I think it was huge. They made the offer, and something like 212 children took them up on it. So you'll see that when they're reaching out to these other students in some of these poorer schools in particular, you may have parents who don't have transportation, who don't have a car, or are working across the city. Boston Latin is not, it's in the Fenway area. People have to travel to get there from all across the city. You're talking about kids who might be involved who live in all corners of the city and might have to take buses to get there, otherwise public transportation to get there. So timing-wise, to get there by 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, that can be pretty tough for an 11-year-old. So logistically, the Boston Public Schools do expect older kids to take public transportation, but
right.
these kids are not even there yet. They're not even at that level. So I think it meant a lot for working parents to be able to have that offer, and that is something they're talking about doing now for the testing day as well. A lot of people have talked about barriers for transportation even on those days. The test is not given, the exam that helps determine who will get into Boston Latin and the other two exam schools for the city of Boston is given on a Saturday typically, and so again, parents work schedules and schedules with other children may interfere with that and create another mm-hmm. hurdle that mm-hmm. may stand in the way of a kid who's on the fence about whether he wants to try out for this from
yeah.
getting there.
Well, finally, Stephanie, you got to sit in mm-hmm. on some of these the Exam School Initiative classes.
Mm-hmm.
What were they like? What was the test prep like?
It was pretty tough. It was pretty grueling. I was sitting there. It was very hot. You know, we're in the dog days of summer here. And these kids were not paying much attention to me, but really paying attention to their teacher and still seemed to be on their toes the whole time. I was very impressed. They're really drilling them for this exam. This is very focused on test prep. I saw one teacher who was talking about reading comprehension, and he was really preparing his students to anticipate as they were reading to underline key phrases and pay attention to things that they might be questioned on. He was talking about there are going to be questions that the material isn't directly in the test, but in the passage, but they had to intuit it, and they had to be able to give it back to the questioner in the answer. They had to figure it out. And getting them to think about these things when they don't have much time, mm-hmm. And they are doing a timed test, and just kind of getting those skill sets down, that some kids may prolong it or, you know, waste too much time on one passage. And he's, you know, trying to teach them how to move through it more quickly so that they can be more successful.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see how many of these kids actually go on to sit for the exam, as you mentioned, and what effect that might have on admissions as the next round of students get admitted to the exam schools. Stephanie Ebert, reporter for the Boston Globe. We've got links to her reporting on the Exam School Initiative at radioboston.org. Stephanie, it's always great to have you, and we look forward to having you back.
Thank you, Meghna. Appreciate it.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Donald Trump is scheduled to speak at a predominantly African-American church in Detroit this weekend, the latest in his push to raise his abysmally low poll numbers among black voters. The Public Policy Polling Group released numbers just yesterday that found that 0% of black voters view Trump favorably, I should say. The margin of error there, plus or minus 3%. That's a major problem for the party of Lincoln as a whole, of course. And Trump admitted as much last Saturday in Iowa.
Republicans are the party of Abraham Lincoln. Pretty good president, right? Pretty good. I said, I'm going to be the most presidential president you've ever had. And then I thought about Abraham Lincoln. And I said, well, I don't know. He's pretty tough to beat, right? Abraham Lincoln, he was pretty good. But that is a great Republican, which brings me to a subject that is so important and very personal for me. Nothing means more to me than working to make our party the home of the African-American vote once again. Used to be.
That's Donald Trump on Saturday in Des Moines. But making the GOP the home of the African-American vote once again would mean that in the next 10 weeks, Donald Trump somehow manages to reverse a political trend that's lasted more than half a century. Leah Wright Regoor has written extensively about that history. She's a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of the book The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. And she joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
It's great to have you. First of all, I just wanted to play another piece of tape from Donald Trump speaking recently about African-American voters. This one is probably a little more familiar to listeners, but I think it sort of sets the stage for our conversation. Here he is a little earlier this month in Michigan appealing to black voters.
Look, what do you have to lose? You're living in poverty. Your schools are no good. You have no jobs. 58% of your youth is unemployed. What the hell do you have to lose? And at the end of 4 years, I guarantee you that I will get over 95% of the African-American vote. I promise you.
We should note that even President Obama in 2012 only won 93% of the African-American vote. But Leah Wright Regoor, Donald Trump's tone and word choice aside, this appeal of you know, his claim that African-American voters don't have any better place to go or that the Republicans are their best option, has that been tried before?
So it absolutely has been tried before. And just before, you know, we just get into it, you know, you have to acknowledge that in terms of pickup lines, what the hell do you have to lose is one of the worst things that you can absolutely say, in part because it opens the door to saying, well, actually, this is what we could lose. Mm-hmm. Now, outreach has been tried. Every Republican presidential candidate, you know, dating back pre Barry Goldwater 1964, but every Republican presidential candidate since the big switch in 1936 has done outreach to African-American communities. Now, some candidates have done a better job than others, but they've all still done it. So the idea that, you know, that outreach hasn't been happening is a false one. The problem is that the outreach that's been done has been pretty shoddy.
Shoddy in that it isn't backed up by policies that are fulfilled, or that the language, the choice of language has always been suspect.
So all of the above. So and that may sound like hyperbole, but it's not. There's one of the biggest things that leads to a divide between African Americans and the Republican Party is the belief that African Americans have that the Republican Party just doesn't care about them. And just to give you an example of this. In 2015, about 88% of black voters surveyed said they believed that Donald Trump did not care about issues that mattered to them. And that number has actually held steady for Republican candidates over the last 30 years or so, where black voters will say, this candidate simply just doesn't care about my issues. And so long as black voters believe that the Republican candidate does not care about them or the party doesn't care about them, they will not support them. And so we see that black voters will say things like, the Republican Party has been insulting to me. The Republican Party does not care about the policies that I'm concerned with. And the Republican Party won't even do things like coming into my neighborhood and talking to me. So this has been an issue of contention that has gone on for a very long time, with a lot of frustration, both outside of the party within black communities, but also within the party amongst those groups who are interested in actual reform.
Now, I want to definitely get to that point because it's a really interesting one. But if we could step way back in time, because in your book, The Loneliness of the Black Republican, I mean, it was absolutely a fascinating read. And
thank you.
And there was, I mean, when we talk about the party of Lincoln, let's you know, be honest here, because you quote, for example, you know, no one less than Frederick Douglass, who at one point in time, in an article that you wrote, said the Republican Party is the ship and all else is the sea around us. I mean, Frederick Douglass, right? So, but then, of course, you mentioned you talk about in your book, and you just said it now, that a great shift began. In 1936
roughly,
or so,
yep.
36
roughly
or so, with Roosevelt, with FDR, right? So can you tell us what happened there? What were the specifics that started pulling black voters towards the Democratic Party?
So the answer is both simple and complicated. the simple answer is that race and economics really shift African-American partisanship during that period. So on the economic sense, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal programs, many of the New Deal programs, include African-Americans in addressing the very real need of poverty and inequality. Now, this is not necessarily deliberate. In fact, many of these programs include African-Americans by virtue of being colorblind. And in fact, other programs exclude African-Americans because of race. With that said, Eleanor Roosevelt plays an incredible role in the symbolic value of the White House during this period, where she is photographed with African Americans. She invites African Americans to accompany her, and she is instrumental in pushing for African Americans to have a voice on New Deal agencies and organizations. So we begin to see this rapid shift out of the Republican Party, to whom African Americans had been loyal, and into the Democratic Party coalition, the New Deal coalition, roughly around 1936.
Okay, but then as soon as 1939, the GOP itself realized it had a long-term problem on its hands. I mean, it commissioned a report that found that, I mean, it sounds like it happened back in 2012, but it happened in 1939, right? That as long as it tried to aggressively woo white voters, it was going to have a long-term problem with black voters.
Right. So the idea behind this is, and in fact, for the audience, they should know that Ralph Bunche, the Nobel Prize winner, and you know the diplomat and the political scientist, very famous civil rights activist, actually writes the report in 1939. And one of the things that he does is he's highly critical of the New Deal for these racial blind spots, but he's also highly critical of the Republican Party, where he says, if you continue to go after Southern segregationists and white voters, you will alienate black voters forever. And he says, you cannot, I think the phrase is, you cannot hunt with hare and hound. You cannot have both. Mm-hmm. That you either have to be for civil rights or against civil rights. You can't try and play both.
What prevented the GOP at the time from fully embracing that message?
So I think the commitment, the interesting thing is that both parties are struggling with committing to civil rights. Right? It's a reflection of the time, and it's a reflection of the era. In particular, I think the Republican Party is going back and forth amongst itself saying, well, can we be committed to civil rights in the way that black voters need us to be? This means being aggressive on issues like voting rights. This means being aggressive on issues like economics and fair pay or equal access to employment, on ending desegregation in the armed forces and across industries. And so there is a lot of hedging, and you see in the actual report that is issued that the party actually says, well, here, we really like these parts, but we don't like these other parts. Mm. And the parts that they really don't like are the ones that seem to involve doing much more in terms of federal involvement than the others. And the problem, I think, with this is that they're also measuring this against the possibility of winning or moving Southern segregationists into the Republican Party at the same time.
Okay, but to be perfectly fair, I mean, the Democrats aren't wearing a halo during this
time at all.
I mean,
not.
I mean, they have an extreme segregationist wing that cost
Correct.
Them, you know, at least a couple elections at least, right?
Correct. So the interesting, this is where it gets complex and messy. We also have to remember at the same exact time, we have a great migration going on. So African Americans are moving north. And as they're moving north, they are forming alliances with Northern Democrats who realize, hey, wait a second, we can form a coalition, a winning coalition by working with African-American voters. So when we do see black voters in the South, remember, many of them don't have the right to vote. When they do have the right to vote, they're voting Republican. So much of this split that we're seeing does break down on partisan lines, but also geographic and regional lines. Mm-hmm. So Southern segregationists are still very much a problem within the Democratic Party well into the 1960s, whereby, in general, when we see African Americans support the Republican Party at higher levels in presidential elections, it's because they are punishing the Democratic Party for the segregationists that are still within their midst.
Such as in 1956. I mean, 40% of African Americans voted
right.
for Eisenhower?
Right. And so 56, there are a number of things that go into this. There, the Republican Party has put forward a civil rights platform. Brown v. They're still kind of reaping the rewards of the 1956 Civil Rights Act. And then on top of that, the Southern wing of the Democratic Party has reacted viciously and violently to Brown v. Board of Education and desegregation. And so black voters, those black voters that support the Republican Party, are really punishing the Democratic Party for not being able to control its segregationist wing.
Well, I'm speaking with Leah Wright-Rigour. She's a historian and professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican. Leah, this brings us to the Great Switch, as you've mentioned it called, 1964, and it was, the Great Switch was precipitated by this.
Let our republicanism, so focused and so dedicated, not be made fuzzy and futile, by unthinking and stupid labels. I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
That, of course, Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater accepting the GOP nomination at the Republican convention in California in 1964. Now, it was a series of events that coalesced around what Goldwater's campaign meant, which really had this transformative effect amongst African-American voters in the United States.
Absolutely. So this is a watershed moment. This is the moment in this election where 6% of African-Americans support the Republican presidential nominee. So it's a wide just separation of a group that could be previously could be at least consistently counted on to give a quarter or one-third of its vote, of the electorate's vote, to the Republican Party. Now, Goldwater is interesting because he really launches a campaign in the early 1960s that is premised around the idea of buckling down and pushing down on conservative values. And he says, you know, these are constitutional, these are principled ideas, but a large part of what it boils down to is the difference between states' rights and civil rights. Mm-hmm. And now, if you're a black voter during this time and you're watching Goldwater's rise, this is deeply troubling. This is concerning because this is not about, okay, constitutionalism, principled ideas or individualism or kind of all of these what we might call semantics. But instead, I am a second-class citizen, and you're now suggesting that the states should control whether or not I have full equality. So we have to think about, you know, what does that mean in Mississippi? What does that mean in Louisiana? What does that mean in Alabama? And then what happens is, even after Republicans form part of this vital coalition to pass the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the most comprehensive Civil Rights Act that the nation had seen up until that point, the party then turns around and nominates the senator that votes against that very act, which is Goldwater.
I mean, he had called it unconstitutional, but it also said that if it becomes law, that, you know, he wouldn't oppose it as official U.S. law. But yes, you're right; he did indeed vote against it. I mean, and it was just soon. It was soon thereafter with Nixon's campaigns, where you know, many people look upon that and say, look, there we're seeing the full fledged use of race as a political strategy amongst the GOP. And in a way, I have to say, I think Richard Nixon, effectively or not, I mean, I'd like your opinion on this. He faces that head on in the 1968 Republican convention, where in his nomination acceptance address, he actually talked about whether or not his law and order approach, which he so heavily emphasized in his speech, was racist or not. Here's what he said.
And to those who say that law and order is the code word for racism, there and here is the reply. Our goal is justice. Justice for every American. If we are to have respect for law in America, we must have laws that deserve respect. Just as we cannot have progress without order, we cannot have order without progress. And so as we commit to order tonight, let us commit to progress.
You know, it's interesting because I was noticing in another one of your articles, you wrote that in 1962, Nixon had told Ebony magazine that it would be foolish and a violation of GOP principles to give up on black voters. And yet, in his very nomination address in 68, he had to refute allegations that he was running a racist campaign.
Right. And part of this goes to show you just how quickly political transformations happen. So black voters support Nixon, and about a third of the black electorate supports him in the 1960 campaign. By 1968, they are turning away from him. They are rejecting him in full, in part because of his reaction to the urban disorder, to the urban riots of the 1960s, to his reaction to the Kerner Commission on Civil Disorders, which he calls basically, you know, a load of garbage. And when he begins to suggest this idea of law and order and repression and the way that he is talking about protesters and rioters, that alienates a considerable amount of African Americans. You add on to that he has now had backroom dealings with Strom Thurmond, who becomes a Republican during this period. And black voters say this is not the man that we supported or maybe that we understood in 1960. The interesting thing about that clip that we just played is that that actually reflects a shift in Richard Nixon's language. So before, Richard Nixon had been using this language simply of law and order. And he takes on a campaign. He takes on Ed Brooke, the Massachusetts senator, who everyone in the audience should know, takes on the black Republican Massachusetts senator, who says, you cannot talk to people about law and order without adding justice. Because what is law and order if everyone is not treated equally under the law? Then that's just repression. That's why audiences think that what you're talking about is racist. So we begin to see Nixon make adjustments throughout the campaign trail towards the end of the process, although it's still not enough to actually win over a sizable portion of the black vote.
Well, do you think then that, I mean, Donald Trump, who has said he's taking a page from Nixon's campaign, that he could effectively make the same adjustments?
Well, those are adjustments that he could make, but it would also involve talking about what justice actually means. And so in the present day, when many African Americans, recent polling by Gallup and by Pew, have shown that many African Americans believe that they are discriminated under the law, that the justice system is not equal, that Donald Trump would actually have to address this and address it in a nuanced way, right? So it couldn't just be kind of flat or superficial rhetoric, but instead would actually have to address the very issues and through policies that African Americans are talking about and that they're interested in.
Right. I mean, I wish we had another half hour to talk with you, because I'd love to talk to you about Ronald Reagan and his sort of conflicted record on race. I mean, he was the politician who brought us the quote unquote welfare queen. About George W. Bush, who, you know, he was I think the last Republican who actively talked about the big tent, you know, but yet he also had. He, you know, before the NAACP in 2000, when he was running for the White House, he had that famous line about the soft bigotry of low expectations. There's so much to talk about in terms of how the GOP talks about issues that are important about African Americans, first of all, about them, and then about issues that are important to them. And I want to reiterate that we're not putting a halo on the Democratic Party. It's just they're not our focus today.
That's a separate conversation.
But you've also written about how efforts amongst black Republicans themselves from within the party in terms of warning against the shift and warning against the cost that it would or the toll that it would take on the GOP to lose black voters in the manner that they have been. And to that effect, I wanted to play a little bit of tape from former Secretary of State and General Colin Powell. And this is from back in 2013 when he spoke with David Gregory on NBC's Meet the Press. And at the time, he was reacting very strongly to some of the language he was hearing other politicians, Republican politicians, talking about when they spoke about President Obama. And here he is again, Colin Powell, 2013.
When I see a former governor say that the president is shucking and jiving, that's a racial era slave term. When I see another former governor after the president's first debate where he didn't do very well, says that the president was lazy. He didn't say he was slow, he was tired, he didn't do well. He said he was lazy. Now, it may not mean anything to most Americans, but to those of us who are African Americans, the second word is shiftless, and then there's a third word that goes along with it. Birther, the whole birther movement. Why do senior Republican leaders tolerate this kind of discussion within the party?
Now, your book is full of African American members of the GOP. And I think Colin Powell maybe is the most recently memorable and well-known of them, who have repeatedly tried to say, we're losing the black vote and we need to do something to change that. Why is it that you think that every time a primary comes around, that message seems to fall on deaf ears?
So I think there's very much a constant soul searching within the Republican Party, a kind of sorting out of identity. And there's this real belief, I think, within at least elite circles, official circles, strategists, that in order to win over the base, in order to shore up the base, all of our efforts have to be against, right, these other groups, these other big tent groups. So there's a lot of conversation about how this is a zero-sum game, and the type of outreach that we would have to do in order to win over, say, Black or Latino voters is the kind of thing that would drive away the base of our support.
So let me ask you about that, because you yourself write that African Americans are the most partisan group of Americans in the country. I mean, to that effect, has that, I mean, this is in 2016, has that potentially harmed them? I mean, if that's that one of the reasons that's propelling the extreme rhetoric that we hear in the primaries?
So it has and it hasn't. So this is the tough question, right?
Which I asked with 25 seconds left to go.
So the short answer is this is the common criticism that is launched from people on the left, on the right, which is that one party, when you are this partisan, one party will take you for granted, the other party ignores you. The other thing, though, is that being this partisan actually gives African Americans a block vote that allows them to dictate the terms of presidential elections. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag.
Well, we'll have you on. I look forward to having you on again to talk more deeply about the aspects that we didn't touch and this election as
Absolutely.
It continues.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Leah Wright-Ragour, she's a historian and professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.